Welcome to the 155 Election Podcast, interviews with candidates running for mayor, city council, and school board trustee in Hamilton, Ontario. Episode 127. Jeff Beatty, you are running for city councilor in Ward 10. Welcome to the 155 Podcast.
Thanks, Joey. Great to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Firstly, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Who is Jeff Beatty? Well, normally Jeff Beatty doesn't talk in the third person, but who I am is a business owner, dedicated community volunteer, community leader, parent, raising kids in the Stony Creek and Winona community. And I care passionately about my community. I have deep roots in the Stony Creek and Winona area. And I really want to see our community live out its full potential. And I'm very concerned about what the last few years have entailed, particularly for Ward 10, but for the city as a whole.
Why are you running?
Well, as I mentioned a second ago, I'm very concerned about the direction that things have been going in the past 4 years. And really, I had some expectations that perhaps after the last election, things may improve. And maybe I'm just overly optimistic. But in the case of our incumbent councillor, the results weren't resounding. It's basically roughly a 62% change vote against our incumbent councillor. She won with roughly 38%, give or take. And if I was in the shoes of someone like that, I would think that I need to make some improvement. I need to change my game and evolve and grow into a different role and adapt to the needs of the community. And I had hoped that that's what we would see. And unfortunately, it's been 4 more years of status quo. And so I look at this and I say, I think now's the time that we really need to be serious about moving in a new and better direction and set aside these status quo ideas.
Do you live in Ward 10? Yes or no?
Yes.
Does it matter if one lives in the community one seeks to represent?
I think that's my personal belief. I have a lifetime born and raised in the Winona and Stony Creek area, lived in all parts of the ward, lived on Millen Road for a portion of time, so I have some knowledge of that area of the ward. And I think it's not just being from the ward. I think that it's living there on a continual basis. It's not leaving and then coming back periodically. You can't get a true sense of the nuances and the needs of the community unless you're there really every day. And so I think that it's critical.
How have you contributed to your community and our city?
To the community, I've been a lifelong volunteer, about 25 years of community service. I think I first did my first volunteer position in my 20s with the Winona Peach Festival. That's probably my primary point of leadership in the community. I've served in various capacities, volunteered with that organization over the last quarter century, 2.5 decades, including a time on the board of directors. I volunteer with a number of other community organizations, the Easter egg hunt, the Halloween event, our local robotics team in Stony Creek. And I think that it's important to participate at that level because, I mean, somebody has to do the things that get all of these things done. People enjoy the outcomes of the different organizations in their community, but not enough people actually participate and give and volunteer to make them happen. So I'm a firm believer in giving back. I do that with my business as well, my garden center in Winona. We're well known for supporting the community, so I live through that as well. And in 2014, I was elected as the local school board trustee for Ward 9 and 10, and I think had a very successful term in that role, both as a local trustee and as a stint as the vice chair of the board. During the role in trustee locally, we had tens of millions of dollars in new investment in our schools. We rebuilt the Eastdale School, we rebuilt the Memorial School, which is now called South Meadow, and also got investment into Mount Albion, into Collegiate Avenue. So very, very proud of those accomplishments. On a city level, my time as vice chair of the public school board was 2 years between 2016 and 2017. And I really got to see more of the city on that bird's eye view, if you will. Spent some time downtown during pupil accommodation reviews where we were trying to make some improvements to the facilities for the Hess Street School, Strathcona neighborhoods, trying to find some creative solutions to redevelop the Sir Johnny McDonald property. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, but I still have optimism that it's a possibility. And during that tenure, got to make some connections with people in different parts of the city, see the diversity. And when I say diversity, I mean that there's no two communities in Hamilton that are alike. And even I remember being downtown in, I think it was Ward 2, and I was with the trustee at the time, and we were just kind of exploring her neighborhood, and I was learning about the different schools and communities. And I could go from one street corner and cross over into another street corner, completely different than where I'd just been. And you could do that several times. So there's just these different levels of nuance, differences, and unique possibilities throughout the city. And I find that really exciting and encouraging. So that's some of what I did, I'd say, that has a citywide.
What are two of your priorities for Ward 10 and two of your priorities for Hamilton as a whole?
Thanks, Joe. The key priority, the number one issue that is being talked about in Ward 10, comes up time and time again, is what I'm going to call overbuilding. And that deals with development that's taking place in the ward. We know that the ward is going to experience some tremendous growth in the next decade or so. Those plans have been on the books for a while. But what we're seeing is a level of density in mature neighborhoods that is really catching people off guard. What I mean by that is you have very, very low, ultra-low density, single-family detached neighborhoods, mature neighborhoods, in some cases historic neighborhoods. And the developments, the infill developments that are being proposed there are the exact and polar opposite. So you have multi-story, multi-unit buildings that are being proposed that don't have sufficient parking, that don't have any of the infrastructure to support those types of developments, and they're in established neighborhoods, and that's a huge concern for residents. Especially when we don't have transit in Winona, we don't have sufficient roads, we don't have sufficient sidewalks, parks. So there's a massive concern about how this is going to be planned for, dealt with, and the leadership really hasn't materialize. There is no solid plan on how we're going to accommodate this. So in the absence of that solid plan, what it looks like is they're just popping gigantic buildings in mature, established historic neighborhoods with no plan on how to address the inability to service them. And that is really, really upsetting to a lot of people. The other ward issue that people are talking about is our lack of transit. And this one's kind of interesting, Joe, because the city already owns a portion of land at the Winona Crossing development at 50 Road. It's intended to be developed as a transit hub. The development is several years old now. Nearly a decade, maybe 15 years of planning has gone into this. So it's not like we're being caught off guard. We've known about this, but there's still no plan to extend transit from Jones Road to 50 Road. Currently, the bus ends at Jones Road. There's nothing there. It's surrounded by nothing. It goes nowhere. And yet we have a destination like the Winona Crossing development where people would want to travel to shop for healthcare reasons. There's educational facilities there. There's tutoring businesses that have popped up. Getting all to these destinations. And then on top of that, local business owners that I talked to in the plaza, I've become friends with a number of them. They talk to me all the time that they're having trouble attracting qualified labor. There's a labor shortage. And if transit was available, it would enable these businesses and all the businesses in between 50 Road and Jones Road to fill those labor shortages, be more productive, grow their businesses, grow the economy, pay more tax, all of these things. And I'd certainly like to facilitate doing that. So for the city, I think that the most important, the pressing issue on a citywide level, well, there's actually two. I'm going to say that citywide infrastructure is a major issue. We all travel throughout the city. We see the conditions of our roads, of our sidewalks, of our parks. The pace of maintenance is not being upkept. Redevelopment is not being upkept. Things are deteriorating faster than they're being rebuilt. And there's a lot of concern about where exactly are our tax dollars going, if not into proper renewal projects. So that's a major issue. And then lastly, I would say city governance is extremely important. Over the past few years, I think that people's faith and trust in our city government has deteriorated. And that would be a key priority for me on a citywide issue, is to restore trust, to restore transparency, so people have faith in their city government again. I think that that is the building block, the foundation of everything we do moving forward. If you don't have faith in your leadership, I don't see how we move forward and get ourselves into a better position. So restoring that, being transparent, being open and honest is going to be a key citywide issue. And I'm very much in favor of doing that.
For listeners at home, we are recording this at the Valley Park Library branch on a weekday morning, and you're hearing in the background some of the children's programming in the library. What are three skills you will bring to elected office that makes you the best choice to represent Ward 10 on Hamilton City Council?
Three skills that I can bring to the table. I think my knowledge of the community, my history in the community would be one of them. And I'm not going to give any order or priority to any skill. I think it's a collection of things that you need to have. Having been born and raised and grown up in Stony Creek, attended school, and now raising a family here, I think that having that background and knowing the different nuances and the different parts of the community is extremely important. You can only get that by being here. It's not something that you can parachute in and pretend that you have knowledge of something, because the community continues to evolve and change, and you can only get that knowledge by being here firsthand. Something else that I think would be an asset is a business background. I run a business in the ward, and that gives me some knowledge of how things work on a budget line, on how things work in a systematic order. And I think that that would be very beneficial for an upcoming council, you know, ensuring that we get a good return on our investments, that our tax dollars are being spent wisely, things of that nature. And I can add that to the table and the conversation. And the last thing, I spent a number of years on community boards of directors for local community groups. And between 2014 and 2018, was elected as the school board trustee. So sat around that board, chaired various committees, served as vice chair. So I have knowledge of how committee structure is intended to work, good governance practices, decorum around the table. And although the school board and those community groups are not a direct comparator to what you would be doing at council, I think that it front loads my position and gives me a leg up on being able to hit the ground running, as it were, with those built-in past experiences.
The following preamble leads to questions regarding honesty and transparency. Let's presume you are elected. During your first few weeks, you will be briefed regarding what City Hall refers to as confidential matters. We do not know what confidential matters are presently being withheld from the citizens of Hamilton. All four councillors first elected in 2018 initially voted to support the Coots Paradise cover-up, before three of the new councillors began voting against the continuing cover-up. The Municipal Act prohibits members of council from releasing information the majority of council declares confidential. With all of this in mind, what principles and advice will help you determine what information should be confidential and what information should be made public?
Going back to what I said a moment ago with my experience at the school board, in that capacity, I had to deal with confidential matters from time to time. And at a school board level, the Education Act is pretty prescriptive that matters of personnel and matters of property are to be in camera, and for obvious reasons. Over and above that, there would have to be very careful consideration given as to what should be classified as, you know, quote unquote confidential. So I would use that as my foundation moving into this role. Is it dealing with property? Is it dealing with personnel? And after that, are we starting to talk about things that, you know, maybe an issue of risk, of liability, a reputational risk, things like that? But the difference being, Joe, those issues, if they aren't pertaining to property or personnel, most of those issues are going to come out at some point. So it comes down to a decision. Do you want to be proactive and get out in front of these issues that are going to present themselves with some integrity, with proactive plan on how you're going to deal with it, kind of fall on your sword, as the saying goes? Or do you want to wait and be reactive when it eventually unfolds. And I think that the sewer gate, quote unquote, issue kind of highlights what happens when you aren't proactive, when you wait and take a wait and see approach. And I think that it was more damaging in the long run. They may have thought that they were doing something proper at the time. I can't speak to what conversations were taking place, but my firm belief and my moral code says get out in front of it, deal with it early, and you will be in a better position overall in the long run. That said, if something is labeled confidential, I'm not going to break the Municipal Act. I'm not going to be one of those people. I'm not going to be leaking confidential things, but I would be advocating very strongly for minimizing the use of that label to those key issues that I think require them.
The Red Hill Inquiry will issue its report early in the next term of council. The revelations regarding how City Hall ignored problems on the expressway and the toxic culture at City Hall, which silenced good people, are shocking. How do you plan to review and consider the final inquiry report when the commission releases its findings and recommendations?
I'm going to admit to you, if I am successful and I am sitting around the council table, this will have been my first judicial report findings that I will have gone through. I have had experience with auditor's recommendations. We had that at the school board, but this would be my first judicial inquiry. But I think that the outcomes are similar in that you look at what are the areas that can be accomplished first? What are the quick wins, for lack of a better term? What can we do within our power in a relatively quick amount of time to implement some of the recommendations and to start to build some momentum and regaining trust? After that, it's going to be determining what the other recommendations are, how they impact us operationally, from a tax basis, things like that. What are the expenses involved? But I can't see us as an organization not taking this seriously and not implementing the recommendations because they are coming from a place of prevention for future events. Again, it comes back to status quo. If we continue doing the same thing over and over again without adjusting our course and without making changes, we are doomed to repeat these things over and over again. So implementing the findings and the recommendations, absolutely, but it's determining a plan, a solid plan on how and when. And I think also putting a deadline on it too, that we are going to commit to doing these things by this date. And that gives us a goal and a deadline. And I think the pressure of a deadline sometimes is beneficial in that regard. So that's how I would go about doing this.
The construction of the B-Line LRT will begin during this term of council. It will be the largest construction project in Hamilton's recent history. How do you plan to respond to construction challenges and opportunities?
I think that the B-Line is not going to touch on Ward 10. So I don't see that I'm going to have a direct connection to the construction. It will all be indirect through various committees, through interactions with other counselors, staff members, et cetera, et cetera. I'm a business owner, so I'm obviously going to have some insight into what kind of impact this is going to have on businesses. And that's going to be a built-in concern of mine. I always stick to a saying, we have a saying in our house, that you can accomplish anything with a good plan. And that's what I've instilled in my kids. And that's kind of the basis that I use for everything that I do, whether it's my own business or raising my kids or whatever it is I do in the community. And I would apply this to this issue as well. Have a good plan. Be transparent with the stakeholders involved, the businesses along the route, the residents along the route. Be communicative. Have conversations. Listen as much as you talk. Take their input. Consider it. And be adaptive along the way. If we notice something that is not working, it's not going well, we have to be flexible in the plan to make course corrections, as the saying would go, and ensure that we minimize the impact on residents and businesses, because it is going to be tremendously disruptive. I've been up to Toronto, where the Eglinton Crosstown is being built, and it's tremendously disruptive. And I would expect the same for Hamilton. So we have to get out in front of this, be proactive, put together a solid plan, and be able to pivot on both opportunities and concerns and challenges.
What is something interesting or unique within Ward 10 that you believe the rest of Hamilton should know about?
Did you know, Joey, that in the late 1800s, Winona was actually a resort community? There was a steamship that came across Lake Ontario. There was a hotel at the foot of Winona Road, where Leona Gardens used to be. And it was a big hotel, and there were clusters of private cottages along the lakeshore. Some of them, very few, still exist along Winona Park Road and Windermere. And people would vacation in the Winona area as if they were vacationing in, let's say, Muskoka or the Kawarthas. That was the thing to do.
City Council decides land use planning and zoning. It decides where housing and businesses are located and the type of housing and businesses which are permitted in location. Ward 10 has and will continue to experience significant population growth. During the past two decades, this has primarily been north of the QEW and single detached homes in the eastern portions of Stony Creek, Winona. The Fruitland Winona Secondary Plan, approved a decade ago, will see further growth. Additionally, low-density large commercial sites along Highway 8 and Barton Street are being converted to mid-rise residential, often by order of the Ontario Land Tribunal. The OLT recently approved 11 stories on Highway 8. Growth is coming. Your job as councillor is to manage it to achieve optimum outcomes within the constraints of Ontario's de facto planning law, the provincial policy statement. There are three topics on this question. Development in Stony Creek has been done without much thought to transit and without adding transit service. The result is growing traffic issues. What is your overall traffic management vision for Ward 10? Please explain how you will achieve the vision.
So there are some plans already underway. We've been in a early planning process in our neck of the woods in the Winona area with regards to Barton Street, Highway 8, and 50 Road. Some of the proposals are not sitting well, I'd say, with the community, because they propose converting some of our arterials, Barton Street and Highway 8, into what I could best describe as five-lane highways. And that is causing some concern, and it seems inconsistent, really, with a lot of the planning practice and the traffic management practice that we see in other parts of the city where they're actually converting these larger streets and they're undergoing a road diet, I think is the term, where they're reducing capacity to make the spaces more livable. So right from the beginning, what I would suggest is that when you're putting new roads in existing historic mature neighborhoods, let's not destroy the neighborhood at the expense. And let's not put ourselves in a position where we find ourselves 10 years, 20 years down the road going, oh, this wasn't such a good idea. Now we're going to do a road diet. I think that the proposal is overly aggressive for certain portions of the route that's being planned. And I think I could say that moving people in a more direct route towards either the service road, maybe some improvements to the service road as an arterial, because that is where you can find better connections to the QEW. And it's all based on going to the QEW. The majority of people that are moving into the area are hopping on the highway and going to work. Moving them in a more efficient way in a north-south configuration, particularly I would say north of Barton Street, using those roads that are primarily going through commercial industrial areas, moving people towards the South Service Road and beefing up the South Service Road to accommodate volume to get people as quickly as possible and as efficiently as possible, not necessarily quickly, but efficiently, towards either Fruitland Road or 50 Road, and minimize the traffic that's traveling through some of our established communities. Tethered with that, I already talked about a priority with transit. We don't have transit right now. We have a very inefficient transcab system. So I would like to redirect the funding that goes towards the transcab to proper transit, bring it to 50 Road, and even incorporated a little bit further into Grimsby, we have a GO station that is 2 or 3 kilometers from the proposed transit hub at 50 Road. So let's integrate fully into the GO bus network, which would minimize car traffic and really give people a variety of options for mobility.
City of Hamilton is updating its outdated citywide residential zoning bylaws. The primary effect of this in Ward 10 is the updating of local regulations regarding secondary dwelling units. Ontario's planning law permits SDUs as of right. As ward councillor, at times you will have to balance the requirements of the provincial policy statement with local opposition to planning proposals. What is your planning philosophy, and how will you handle contentious files which you know will be approved by the Ontario Land Tribunal, even if City Council decides to oppose them?
Well, there's a couple of key points that I pull out. Number one, I don't think that I would ever presume to know the outcome of the OLT, because I don't think anybody would be wise to bet on OLT outcomes, because you never know where they're going to fall. To say that there's going to be some challenges, absolutely there's going to be some challenges. I come from a mind where, in certain circumstances, I think that there's a benefit to some of what's being proposed in SDUs, particularly in the case of where you may have multiple generations of families living in the same dwelling. I'll give the example. My parents live in a family home. This is where my grandfather was born. And over the course of history, it has been duplexed and then unduplexed, and some apartments put in for family members to live in so that they can age in place. And I feel very strongly that that's of benefit, particularly given the current landscape of long-term care homes, and et cetera. I think people are going to be looking to that option more and more. So making space available for mom and dad in a secondary dwelling unit on premise does two things. It allows better care, I think, for our aging population, but it also gives the younger generation an opportunity to perhaps come into the housing market with some family assistance, build some equity, and then have a springboard from which to jump off from. The downside, of course, is when you start to get private investment involved. And I've already heard from neighbors within the Ward 10 area, and kind of the Eastdale area, actually, that have seen this happen. Investors purchase a single-family home, they partition it and rent out different portions as multiple dwelling unit, and they have had very poor experiences with it. Increases in criminality, prostitution, I don't mind saying that, has actually occurred, and that's something that you don't want to see in the community. So balancing between the need for more rental units, the need for increasing the density in certain areas, but you have to balance that against creating an environment where you're causing problems in the community. I always believe that development of any kind should enhance the community around it. It should never be a detriment to the community. So it'll be an ongoing conversation. I think that there should be some strict regulations and some guidance on how these things are to progress. And I think that anytime that this is occurring in the neighborhood should never be caught off guard. There has to be a certain amount of transparency and two-way conversation so people know what to expect, so they're not waking up one morning and finding that a single-family home now suddenly has four different families living in it. I don't think that's fair to the community and the taxpayers.
The conversion of large commercial lots to mixed-use residential is occurring across Hamilton. Already there are applications on Highway 8 near Millen Road and near DeWitt Road. The city is finishing sewage upgrades along DeWitt Road, which were 50% development charge funded. This means the city must approve new development in this area. Presently, there is no city planning policy specific to commercial and mixed-use redevelopment. What is your vision for this type of redevelopment, and how will you achieve that vision?
I think it comes back to what I was just alluding to. There has to be transparent conversation with the existing community. The new proposed developments are going to be initially disruptive because we've gone so long with a certain way of developing. We have to make sure that we're not causing more net harm to the surrounding communities when we allow this to take place. But I do look at a strip plaza, for example, which is basically, you know, one story of retail. They're not terribly efficient use of space. And re-looking at that with residential component above the commercial space, that's what was done up until about 1920 or 1930. That was the standard. You always made the best use of space. You always had a certain amount of residential above your commercial units. We went away from it after the Second World War, and now I think we're having to relook at that. But it's not necessarily, I don't think, in going to a massive high density volume on these sites, because again, that isn't necessarily fair to the surrounding community. It's finding a balance. If it's going to be mid-rise, if it's going to be a term that we don't talk enough about, the missing middle, mid-rise units, making better use of it, but it has to have a net benefit to the community and enhance the community in some way and not cause detriment.
Road safety is a significant issue across Hamilton, including in Ward 10. What is your overall plan to address road safety? Please provide 3 detailed specifics of your plan and how you will respond to opposition to changes.
Well, there's always going to be opposition to change. I think that's inherent with society in general. I use 3 E's when I'm looking at road safety: education, enforcement, and effective design. Education, obviously, if we look at what is causing people to drive in an erratic behavior and try to understand why this is happening, it almost seems in some cases, and I don't want to generalize, but through social media influences and things of that nature, there may be a small portion of the population that doesn't really believe that the rules apply to them. You see them driving in a manner that is completely irresponsible, and you have to wonder, why is this occurring and what are we doing to address it? So I think education on the impacts of unsafe driving, whether it's to yourself and to others around you, that's going to be a key component, but you have to do it in a way that reaches your intended audience. Throwing a little banner in the local newspaper that says, hey, slow down and drive more effectively, that's not going to reach your target audience anymore. You have to be more creative than that. You have to hit people where they live. It's going to involve different social media campaigns. It's going to be going into places like TikTok. It's going to be going into places like Instagram. And it's going to be creating content that will catch people's attention and really make them think about their choices. I think that's going to be really important. The second one is enforcement. I don't think that anybody would argue that we have too much police enforcement of traffic currently. There's always room for improvement on that, having more officers on the streets, conducting blitzes, but also doing it in a very open and transparent way. I'll give you an example. I follow a Twitter account for a police officer in Halton region, and this particular officer, he's one of the enforcement units, and he is constantly highlighting what he's finding in his enforcement stops, whether it's people driving at 100 kilometers over the speed limit, which is mind-blowing that that even occurs, but it does. Whether it's modifications to vehicles that are unsafe and not good for the environment, he's very public in letting people know about these things, and he has a good following. And I wonder, is there a Made in Hamilton equivalency to that? Do we know enough about it, and how do we promote that so that we know that the enforcement is taking place? Police officers are out there, bylaw officers are out there, MTO officers are out there, and they're monitoring this stuff, and they're waiting for people that are breaking the law and behaving in an unsafe manner. So the last part, I would say, is the effective road design. And there's a number of tools that we have in our traffic calming toolbox. Unfortunately, our incumbent counselor doesn't believe in all of them. She's flat out said that speed bumps, for example, are not something that she approves of. I think taking any piece of the toolbox out before you have an opportunity to explore the individual need in the community, I think that that's not good planning. But I would want to look at each situation with planning staff, with the proper staff from traffic department, with input from police department, and say, what can we do in this instance, on this street, in this neighborhood, with this bag of tools to achieve a particular outcome of making things safer for pedestrians, cyclists, and for motorists as well. We can't forget that the motorist can be in a situation of peril when we're not driving properly, in addition to the other stakeholders involved.
Turning to governance and expertise, let's use the idea that it takes 10,000 hours to master a skill or trait and apply it to being a municipal counselor. One person cannot be an expert in all matters, but should come before council for a decision. How will you gain the necessary learning to be able to make informed decisions? What reading do you do? What professional development will you look for? And what types of people will you seek advice from?
So I would take my expertise in business, my knowledge in business as a business owner, and I would apply it very similarly in this. In my industry, I keep abreast of local trends. I talk with experts in the field. I read publications. I keep up to date on trends. I keep myself informed to things that pertain to my industry and my business. And I would apply that model in the same way for city government and city governance issues and planning issues and things of that nature. Ask the right questions to the right people, read the right documents, and don't be afraid to admit what you don't know. I think that's really key. Go and seek the answers from those who are in a position of knowledge and act in a trustworthy manner.
What are two changes you will propose to improve city services?
I think overall, improving the culture at City Hall, making the staff feel that they have a mission to improve the lives of Hamiltonians. And I don't know, when you call into City Hall, I think we have a lot of good people there. I think that the majority of our city employees are excellent and want to make things better. But for whatever reason, the culture doesn't exist to support them doing that. So it's pivoting the culture at City Hall to make it very forward-looking. How can we help? How can we improve? We're all in this together. And we have to back that up with some concrete examples. So it will be a little bit of lead by example. I think that's number one. And then number two is making sure that we resource these ideas at the same time. So saying that you want to do things is one thing, but actually resourcing them properly and not just making them window dressing, I think that's going to be key as well.
What are two changes you will propose to improve quality of life in Hamilton?
This is a very big question, and I think that it's difficult, and I'll say it like this. Understanding the different perspectives at play, what improves my quality of life may be very different than what improves your quality of life. So it's a matter of understanding what will be uplifting to the majority of Hamiltonians. I think feeling confidence in your city government is important. I feel that creating an environment of trust and understanding, two-way conversations, I think that that's the foundation for it. But at the end of the day, it's such a nuanced issue that everybody's going to respond in a different way to what's going to improve my quality of life or your quality of life or the next person's quality of life. So putting those pillar foundational pieces in place that will support being able to make that a really nuanced and unique experience for individual Hamiltonians, individuals, communities within Hamilton.
It's 2026. The public record is writing a review of the 4-year council term that is just ending. What 3 words do you hope we will use to describe your term on council? And what 3 words do you hope will describe council as a whole?
I think I would want to be thought of as effective, as collaborative, and forward-looking. Having a plan in place for what comes next, being able to work together cohesively and effectively, and being effective, actually getting things done, having things accomplished, whether it's a plan for future accomplishments or some of the more short-term wins that we'll be able to do. I'd like to think that people would look back and say, yeah, these folks really, they did it. They were really able to pull it together and pivot away from some of the directions that our status quo thinking incumbents have been leading us in.
Thank you. That's the end of the prepared questions you were sent in advance. Do you have any closing remarks you wish to share?
Joe, I thank you for the opportunity to be here. Obviously, this is a really, really important election. I feel perhaps more important than my last go in 2018. I took 2018 as a learning opportunity on how to grow and prepare and to do better for this election. And I'm very excited to use those learnings in a productive way to get things done. I'm not proposing to turn City Hall on its head and shake everything out, although that does sound fun to some. What I would like to do, though, is to restore trust in government, to get concrete plans put in place, and fundamentally just to make some change for the better.
Thank you for joining us. How do people find out more about you, and where do they follow you on social media?
You can go to jeffbeattie.ca. All of my social media outlets are posted there as well, but I run the full spectrum, Joey. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, and I even joined TikTok. So that's a little bit scary, but you can find me there as well.
This has been episode 127 of the Public Records, the 155 podcast. Thank you to the Hamilton Public Library for the use of their makerspaces to record these podcasts. Thank you to the readers and listeners of the Public Record for your support. You can visit thepublicrecord.ca to get more City Hall coverage, sign up for my City Hall newsletter, and become a member of the press club to keep me covering Hamilton City Hall. Thank you.